Chapter 3. The Insider. Amnon Rappaport was just 18 years old when he was identified by the Israeli army's new selection system as leadership material. They'd made him a tank commander. "I didn't even know there was a tank corps," he said. One night in October 1956, he drove his tank into Jordan to avenge the murder of several Israeli civilians. On these raids, you never knew what decisions you might have to make quickly. Shoot or hold fire. Kill or let live. Live or die. A few months earlier, an Israeli soldier Amnon's age had been captured by the Syrians. He decided to kill himself before they could question him. When the Syrians sent his body back, the Israeli army found a note in his toenail. "I never betrayed." On that night, in October 1956, Amnon's first decision had been to stop firing. His job was to bombard the second floor of a Jordanian police building until Israeli paratroopers stormed the ground floor. He worried about killing his own men. After he'd stopped shelling, he heard over his tank's radio reports from the ground. And all of a sudden, the reality hit me. This was not just an adventure with heroes and villains acting their role. People were dying. The paratroopers were Israel's elite fighting force. Their unit, in hand-to-hand combat, was suffering serious casualties, and yet their reports from the battle to Amnon's ears inside the tank sounded calm, almost casual. "There was no panic," he said. "Indeed, no change of intonation and hardly any expression of emotion. These Jews had become Spartans." How had that happened? He wondered how he would fare in hand-to-hand combat. He aspired to be a warrior, too. 2 weeks later, he drove his tank into Egypt in what turned out to be the start of a military invasion. In the fog of battle, he was strafed not just by Egyptian but also Israeli warplanes. His most vivid memory was of an Egyptian MiG-15 diving straight down on his tank while he, with his head above the turret to maintain a 360-degree view of the battlefield, shouted at his driver to zig and zag to avoid being hit. It felt like the MiG was on a special assignment to blow off his head. A few days later, desperate Egyptian soldiers in full retreat approached Amnon's tank with their arms in the air. They begged for water and protection from the Bedouins who hunted them for their rifles and boots. The day before, he was murdering these people. Now all he felt toward them was pity. He marveled again at how easy it is to shift from an efficient killing machine to a compassionate human being, and how quick the switch may be. How did that happen? After the battles, Amnon just wanted to get away from it all. "I was a little bit wild after 2 years in the tank," he said. "I wanted to go as far away as possible. Flying out of the country was too expensive. Israelis in the 1950s didn't talk about combat stress or its discontents. They just dealt with it." He took a job in the copper mine in the desert just north of the Red Sea, said to be one of the legendary mines of King Solomon. His math skills were better than any of the other workers, most of whom were prison labor, and so he was made the mine's bookkeeper. Among the conveniences that King Solomon's mine was unable to provide was a toilet, or toilet paper. "I went out to take a shit. I saw a note in the newspaper that I took to wipe my ass. It said they were opening a psychology department at Hebrew University." He was 20 years old. What he knew of psychology was Freud and Jung. There were not many textbooks in psychology in Hebrew, but the subject interested him. He couldn't say why. Nature had called. Psychology had answered. Entrance into Israel's first psychology department, unlike entrance into most Hebrew university departments, was to be competitive. A few weeks after he'd read the ad in the newspaper, Amnon stood in line outside the monastery that served as Hebrew University, waiting to take a series of bizarre tests, including one designed by Danny Kahneman, who had written a page of prose in a language he had invented so that applicants might attempt to decipher its grammatical structure. The line of applicants ran down the block. There were only 20 or so spots in the new department, but hundreds of people wanted into it. An amazing number of young Israelis in 1957 wanted to know what made people tick. The talent was also incredible. Of the 20 people admitted, 19 went on to earn their doctorates, and the one who didn't was a woman who, scoring one of the top marks on the admissions test, then had her career derailed by children. Israel without a psychology department was like Alabama without a football team. In line beside Amnon stood a small, pale, baby-faced soldier. He looked about 15, but he wore, almost absurdly, the high rubber-soled boots and crisp uniform and red beret of the Israeli paratrooper, the new Spartan. Then he started to speak. His name was Amos Tversky. Amnon wouldn't remember exactly what he had said, but he'd remember vividly how he'd felt about it. I was not as smart as he was. I understood it immediately. To his fellow Israelis, Amos Tversky somehow was, at once, the most extraordinary person they had ever met and the quintessential Israeli. His parents were among the pioneers who had fled Russian anti-Semitism in the early 1920s to build a Zionist nation. His mother, Genia Tversky, was a social force and political operator who became a member of the first Israeli parliament, and the next four after that. She sacrificed her private life for public service and didn't agonize greatly about the choice. She was often gone. She spent 2 years of Amos's early childhood in Europe, helping the U.S. Army liberate the concentration camps and resettle the survivors. Upon her return, she spent more time at the Knesset in Jerusalem than at home. Amos had a sister, but she was 13 years older, and he was raised, in effect, as an only child. The person who did most of that raising was his father, a veterinarian who spent much of his time treating livestock. Israelis couldn't afford pets. Yosef Tversky, the son of a rabbi, despised religion and loved Russian literature, and found a great deal of amusement in what came out of the mouths of his fellow human beings. His father had turned away from an early career in medicine, Amos explained to friends, because he thought animals had more real pain than people and complained a lot less. Yosef Tversky was a serious man. At the same time, when he talked about his life and work, he brought his son to his knees with laughter about his experiences and about the mysteries of existence. "This work is dedicated to my father, who taught me to wonder," Amos would one day write at the opening of his PhD dissertation. Amos was fond of saying that interesting things happened to people who could weave them into interesting stories. He, too, could tell a story with startlingly original effect. He spoke with a slight lisp that reminded some of the way that Catalan spoke Spanish. He was so pale that his skin was almost translucent. Whether he was speaking or listening, his pale blue eyes darted back and forth, as if searching for an approaching thought. Even as he spoke, he gave the impression of constant motion. He wasn't conventionally athletic, he was always small, but he was loose-jointed and fast, twitchy, and incredibly agile. He had an almost feral ability to run at great speed up and down mountains. One of his favorite tricks, he'd sometimes do this as he told a story, was to place himself on a high surface, whether a rock or a table or an army tank, and fall face first toward the ground. His body perfectly horizontal to the earth, he'd fall until people shrieked, and then he'd pull himself up at the last moment and somehow land on his feet. He loved the sensation of falling and the view of the world from above. Amos was also physically brave, or at least intent on seeming so. Not long after his parents moved him from Jerusalem in 1950 to the coastal city of Haifa, he found himself at a swimming pool with other kids. The pool had a 10-meter diving platform. The kids challenged him to jump off it. Amos was 12 years old, but didn't yet know how to swim. In Jerusalem, during the War of Independence, they hadn't had water to drink, much less to fill swimming pools with. Amos found a big kid and said, "I'm going to do this, but I need you to be in the pool when I land to pull me up from the bottom." Amos jumped, and the big kid rescued him from drowning and pulled him out of the pool. Entering high school, Amos, like all Israeli kids, needed to decide if he would specialize in math and science or in the humanities. The new society exerted great pressure on boys to study math and science. That's where the status was and the future careers. Amos had a gift for math and science, perhaps more than any other boy, and yet, alone among the bright boys in his class, and to the bemusement of all, he pursued the humanities, another risky leap into the unknown. He could teach himself math, Amos said, and he couldn't ignore the thrill of studying with the humanities teacher, a man named Baruch Kurzweil. "In contrast to most of the teachers who spread boredom and superficiality, I'm full of enjoyment and amazement in his classes in Hebrew literature and philosophy," Amos wrote to his older sister Ruth, who had moved to Los Angeles. Amos wrote poetry for Kurzweil and told people he planned to become a poet or a literary critic. He formed an intense private, possibly romantic relationship with a new student named Dalia Ravakovich. She turned up one day morosely in their high school class. After her father's death, she'd lived on a kibbutz, which she loathed, and bounced unhappily through a series of foster homes. She was the picture of social alienation, or at any rate the 1950s Israeli version of it, and yet Amos, the most popular kid in the school, took up with her. The other kids didn't know what to make of it. Amos still looked like a boy. Dahlia seemed, in every way, already a grown woman. He loved the outdoors and games. She, well, when all the other girls went out to gym class, she sat at the window and smoked. Amos loved being with big groups of people. Dahlia was a loner. It was only later, when Dahlia's poetry claimed Israel's highest literary prizes and she became a global sensation, that people said, "Oh, that made sense. Two geniuses." Just as it made sense after Baruch Kurzweil became Israel's most prominent literary critic that Amos had wanted to study with him. But it did, and it didn't. Amos was the most insistently upbeat person anyone knew. Dahlia, like Kurzweil, attempted suicide. Kurzweil succeeded. Like a lot of the Jewish kids in Haifa in the early 1950s, Amos joined a leftist youth movement called the Nahal. He was soon elected a leader. The Nahal, the word was an acronym for the Hebrew phrase meaning fighting pioneer youth, was a vehicle to move young Zionists from school onto kibbutzim. The idea was that they would serve as soldiers and guard the farm for a couple of years and then become farmers. During Amos's final year in high school, the swashbuckling Israeli general Moshe Dayan came to Haifa to speak to the students. A boy who happened to be in the audience recalls, "He says all those who go to the Nahal, raise your hands. A huge number did." Dayan says, "You are traitors. We don't want you growing tomatoes and cucumbers. We want you fighting." The next year, every youth group in Israel was asked to pick 12 kids out of every 100 to serve their country not as farmers, but paratroopers. Amos looked more like a Boy Scout than an elite soldier, but he volunteered immediately. Too light to qualify, he drank water until he made weight. At paratrooper school, Amos and the other young men were turned into symbols of the new country, warriors and killing machines. Cowardice wasn't an option. Once they'd proven that they could jump to the ground from a height of 18 feet without breaking anything, they were taken up in old World War II planes built of wood. Their propeller was at the same level as the door, but just in front of it, so there was this strong gust of wind to throw you backward the moment you stepped out. The light on the door was red. They checked each other's equipment until the light turned green, and one by one, they moved forward. Anyone who hesitated was pushed out. The first few jumps, a lot of the young men hesitated. They needed a little push. One kid in Amos's group refused to jump and was ostracized for the rest of his life. "It took real bravery not to jump," a former paratrooper later said. Amos never hesitated. "He was always on the extreme end of enthusiastic when it came to jumping out of airplanes," recalls fellow paratrooper Uri Shamir. "He jumped 50 times, maybe more. He jumped behind enemy lines. He jumped into battle in 1956 in the Sinai campaign. Once he jumped by accident into a hornet's nest and was stung so badly he passed out." After university in 1961, he flew for the first time in his life without a parachute to graduate school in the United States. As his plane descended, he looked at the earth below with genuine curiosity, turned to the person sitting beside him, and said, "I've never landed."